Today's episode of Data Driven is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/datadriven.
Hello and welcome to Data Driven, the podcast where we explore the emerging field of data science. We bring the best minds in data, software engineering, machine learning, and artificial intelligence. Now here are your hosts, Frank Lavinia and Andy Leonard.
Hello and welcome back to Data Driven, the podcast where we discuss the new oil, that is data. And with me as always is Andy Leonard. How you doing, Andy?
I'm well, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm working my way through the data science certification, and I'm in the middle of class 8.
Wow. So how many classes are there?
There are 10 total before I will be crowned a Jedi in the data sciences. And yeah, the 8th class so far has been probably the most challenging because it's entirely hands-on.
Oh, okay.
With not a lot of guidance from the instructor. So,
okay. That's probably good feedback.
Yes. I've been very active in the forums about basically expressing that. So, the harder the class, I think the more you learn.
Right.
Because I know for me personally, once I did the stats class, that was the point where I felt like I was a data scientist, you know, at least a Padawan data scientist. And if you have no idea what I'm talking about, it's all Star Wars stuff. And if you've seen Star Wars but not the prequels, consider yourself lucky.
But you're also talking about the certification that Microsoft has released for data science and cooperation with edX. And a bunch of us are going through it. I know some people who've already gone through the initial offering. I'm making my way through very slowly. I'd like to finish by the end of 2017, but who knows? I found the material so far very interesting, but I'm not on lesson 8. I think I'm around 3 or 4. And I haven't looked at it in a couple of weeks because I signed up to write a new book on BIML, and that's been keeping me busy. Lots of fun, great team writing that book, but that's what I've been up to. So it's all good. It's good to keep writing, good to keep learning. And speaking of learning, I've learned an awful lot from our guest today. I'm very honored to call Donald Farmer a friend, and he's one of my heroes. He worked at Microsoft. I hope Donald will expand on his experience with the SSIS team. I first made contact with Donald as we were working on my first book, which was on SSIS. It was one of the first books released on SSIS 2005. I realized he was... I didn't know who you were, Donald, when we first met, but swapping some emails with you and then talking to, I believe, Brian Knight, who led that team of authors, he was, I think, very impressed, first off, that you answered my email because I was just a little punk nobody, and second, that that I was communicating with you and didn't realize who you were. But these days, Donald is the principal of Tree Hive Strategy. And we'll talk some about where that name came from. It's an interesting story. Donald has over 30 years of global experience in data management, analytics, and software product design. And with that, he brings knowledge, experience, and connections to his role as principal at TreeHive. You can find TreeHive Strategy online at treehivestrategy.com. And they principally work with other experts to bring you even greater breadth and depth to software development and thinking about all of these things that in the perspective of data. So, Donald, welcome.
Thank you very much. What an introduction. Thank you. It's really delighted to speak to you again.
Same here. And you, I'd love to ask you to tell us more about TreeHive Strategy and the work you guys are doing.
Well, so I have, I kind of jokingly say I've semi-retired. It doesn't feel like I have. But I no longer work for a software vendor. I did work for Microsoft and for Qlik Technologies. But I'm now independent, and TreeHive Strategy is my independent banner. That's me hanging out my shingle. And what I'm doing at TreeHive Strategy is providing advice to investors and to the companies that investors are interested in, and to enterprises who are trying to make sense of their data. And I provide strategic advice. I'm not doing a lot of implementation these days, but I'm more kind of helping people set out their strategic direction, whether that's in investing and development or in implementation.
Interesting. So when you say you help them with their investments, is you in the financial space or just kind of companies in general?
In the financial space, mainly. I'm particularly interested in, a lot of people are, when people talk about investment in software, everybody gets excited about startups. And everybody assumes, kind of the default thing is, oh, yeah, well, you're working with startups. But actually, I'm much more interested in companies in what you might call mid-stage, kind of midlife. Companies are going through a midlife crisis. They've had their initial success. They've built a product. They have a market. They have customers. But now they've got to look at what's their next product? Where does that come from? Where does their next idea come from? How do they build on the market and the technologies that they've developed? And very often they need additional investment to do that, which is very often private equity companies who'll be providing that. And that's a really fascinating area to get involved in. Now, I do advise some startups and in the data and analytics space, and I have great fun doing that. But I actually think this area of the kind of mid-stage companies who are trying to reinvent themselves is underserved and underappreciated as well.
That makes a lot of sense, because a lot of the excitement in the startup world is about, the entrepreneurs who are kind of like just starting, or the unicorns that are, they're not gone public yet, but they're valued over $1 billion,
Right.
There's plenty of there's plenty of road on the startup journey that goes uncovered by most of the startup ecosystem.
Yeah, and the point about a unicorn is it only has one horn. I'm much more interested in the six pointers. They're kind of mature. They've done things.
They sound like scary animals to me.
they can be.
Well, very cool, Donald. So you provided a lot of leadership at Microsoft and on product development, data related product development, and. How did you get into this? How did you get started down this path?
That's it's a very long answer and rather complicated. But let me put it this way. I've always been interested in products. Not necessarily in the commercial side of products, but the idea of taking a problem and encapsulating the answer to that problem in a way that it can be reused and built upon. I had a great advantage when I grew up, which is that we had computers around from quite an early age, and my father was an electronics engineer and was very interested in all sorts of circuitry and computation and digital technology. So we had a lot of this stuff just around. And I never studied computer science formally at all. Not because I wasn't interested, but because I would take it for granted might not be the right word, but it was just part of my background. What I was interested in is what you could do, how you could apply technologies. So I worked as a historian, I worked as an archaeologist, I ended up working in fish farms and forestry and all sorts of things. But all the time I was doing that, I was applying data and data analytics and data science to those problems. So we built databases and analytic systems for managing archaeological sites. I built databases and analytic systems for managing fish farms. And I was never interested in just solving the problem for one archaeological site or for one farm. What I was really interested in was getting down to, how do I genericize this? How do I take this problem, abstract it to the point where I can now apply it to many similar problems? Not just how do I solve this problem, but how do I build an engine that solves this problem many times over? And I've always been fascinated by that. And that's really how I ended up getting into the kind of field of work which eventually led me to work at Microsoft.
Well, I know in one conversation we had earlier, you and this was years ago, you shared some of your experience in fish farming, and we were talking about predictive analytics. Years ago, I did manufacturing automation, and someone who was operating a fish farm wanted to come up with some way to predict how many pounds of fish they had in a given area.
Right.
And I also, if I remember correctly, you have a friend who has an interesting other job who does fish farming as well.
Well, so that's right. I mean, there are there's a lot of interesting people in the fish farming industry, and you might be talking about a friend of mine. Well, somebody I know anyway through the business who used to play the flute standing on one leg.
That's him. Yeah, I thought that was.
Wait, what?
Ian Anderson from Jethro Tull took his money from the music business and invested in a very large estate in Scotland and put a great deal of investment into the local community and into building up local businesses, including some excellent fish farms called Strathaird Salmon, and they were one of my big customers. And with lots of interesting work that we did there in those days.
Very interesting.
Interesting. So you had sensors and whatnot in the, or you just took manual readings or anything like that?
Well, so here's an interesting side of this. There are several interesting data problems to do with fish farming. And yes, you can build sensors in which will do things like measure temperature. And the growth of a fish is related to the temperature of the water and the amount of food it gets. And so you can do calculations like food conversion ratios and so on to kind of manage, you know, the growth of the fish. And then you have to sample your fish at different times. So you take a sample of them, you weigh them, you know, weigh the total sample, take some averages. Now you've got, you know, the number of fish that you've got. But one of the interesting problems with fish farms is that you never know how much fish you actually have at any one time. Because everything is sampled, you can't go in and count every single one of, you know, 500,000 little tiny hatchlings. You simply don't know how many fish you've got. But at the end of the day, when you come to sell these fish to a market, you think of buying a trout or a salmon in a supermarket. Each individual fish has a value, and that value may be quite high. If you're raising salmon for breeding, the value of fish may be, by the way, $800 to $1,000 for a prime breeding salmon. So you can't count how many fish you have. But the value of each individual fish is potentially very high. So at the end of the day, you do a calculation at harvest time. At that point, you do know how many fish you've had. You end up with this value that we might call the overage, which is the difference between what you thought you had and what you really have. And so it's really interesting. It's an area in which everything is very vague until the point it's harvested, and then it becomes very clear. And you've got to account for all that vagueness in the predictions and the calculations that you do. So it's not like making cars, where you know how many cars you're making at any one time. You have no idea how many fish you're making, and then suddenly at the end of the day, you've got a calculation that resolves all of that.
That's really interesting. So it's and it has a lot of parallels, I would say, in a lot of what we're seeing these days in some very modern and very technological areas where growth is organic. And, you know, I can see some parallels between this and things like the Internet of Things, IoT, and big data, and all of these collection and integration problems that I know you've worked on before.
It's interesting. Ambiguity is actually and probability is becoming really important to us. One of the things I frequently tell people in presentations now these days is that we need to get very comfortable with the language of ambiguity in our work. You're doing a data science course, Frank. To me, the language of data science is the language of ambiguity.
That's actually very well stated. I would say one of the things you mentioned is that I think in a manufacturing economy, people are a lot more comfortable with certainty. You know exactly how many cars you have in the assembly line. You don't know necessarily how many you'll sell. But now I would say uncertainty and probability is probably more of a more of a thing in our daily lives, and data modeling around that can make or break a business, if not an industry.
And we think that, you know, we think so many businesses are actually run with very clear insight. Increasingly, businesses don't run on clear insight. They run on probability, because they've discovered that running on probability improves their margins, you know. You know, you don't know, obviously, things like sales and so on. You don't know how many customers are likely to come into your business, but, you know, you can work around the probabilities. But there's been a case in the news just in the last couple of days. You know, you don't even know how many passengers you've booked for your plane, you know, until the plane comes to take off. And regardless of that particular incident, it's still an interesting problem. That's a probability problem. We know we can overbook the plane because we know a certain number of passengers are not going to turn up. That's a probability issue. And it's fascinating that something as precise as running an airline actually runs on probabilities.
It's actually interesting you mention that, because I saw a video the other day on YouTube and talking about how airlines have data models about you know, what different routes are going to have, different times of year are going to have different probabilities of having no-shows.
Yeah.
And what's particularly interesting is that the data for that is considered highly proprietary.
Isn't it? Yeah. Isn't that interesting? And they know that certain people who book on certain airlines are likely to no-show more than on other airlines. If you're buying a discount ticket, interestingly, you know, people buying a discount ticket may actually be more likely to turn up than somebody on a business ticket. And the reason is because somebody paying an expensive business ticket is paying that precisely because they're a business traveler whose timings and whose appointments may change even at the very last minute. I know this happens to me all the time. Somebody flying on a discount ticket may well be the person flying across country to see their kids, who saved up for that ticket, even if it's discounted, and therefore they're not going to miss that plane. You know, that they're determined to get on. So it can actually be quite counterintuitive sometimes. And I think it's really fascinating the way we're starting to build this probabilistic view of the world into the work that we do nowadays. And I think there's two sides to this. There's the probabilistic, the analysis that we do with data nowadays is increasingly probabilistic and vague. At the back end, the work that we do in integrating and bringing all that data together is very similar to what we've done for many years, but it's just on a much larger scale than we've done. So, you know, there's still two sides to this problem. There's the problem of integrating and bringing the data into one place in order to do these calculations. Then there's these fascinating vague calculations that we do at the front end. And increasingly, I think our practices and our expertise in this business is going to become sort of polarized between, do you know the back end data, or do you know this language of ambiguity at the front end?
Well, you mentioned that, Donald, in a recent podcast, I heard you doing on a webinar, rather, not a podcast, where you made this analogy and between the difference between gatekeepers, which has been a traditional data role in an enterprise for database administrators, DBAs, and then I'd say now for really more data professionals. That fall into that category of gatekeeper. I think of people like data governance folks. And, you know, the analogy you made was we are no longer gatekeepers. I'll let you finish that and expand on that some.
Yeah, I'm glad you listened to that. That was this is one of my favorite topics. And what I like to say here is that we have to move from the mindset of being gatekeepers in the data world to being shopkeepers. And the difference between a gatekeeper and a shopkeeper is that a gatekeeper is super focused on keeping people out. You know, I'm the gatekeeper. Everything outside my domain is kind of dangerous and risky, but I'm going to control the system and let people in. And the analogy we use in the data world, we allow data access. I'll give you access to my data. I'm going to control, you're outside, I'm in here, I'm going to control access to the system. That's a mindset that is, if you like, somewhat confrontational. It assumes that the world out there is bad, the world in here is safe, and my job is to be the gatekeeper. The shopkeeper has a completely different approach to the world. The shopkeeper wants people to come in. The shopkeeper wants to prepare their goods to make them look attractive. If they're a grocer, they want to make them look tasty and interesting. And the shopkeeper wants people to come in and browse and take what they want. And the interesting thing about the difference between a shopkeeper and a gatekeeper is that mindset. It's the difference between everything's closed and I'm going to let you in, as opposed to I actually want you to come in. My job is to make things available to you in a way that you will want to consume them. I need to make them safe to consume. I need to make sure they're fit for purpose and fit, of marketable quality. But I still want you to come and use them. And it's not a free-for-all. It's not, I quite often use a slide of a shopkeeper, and she's standing in a store, a little small kind of convenience store, but she's selling booze and cigarettes. Those are governed products. There are rules and regulations around that that she has to apply. But she still wants people to come in. She's still attracting people into the store. And that's a very different mindset. And I think we need to change our mindset for several reasons. But the main reason is because the gatekeeper role is becoming just increasingly impossible to sustain.
Right. I would say one of the things I've noticed throughout my career was that the DBA was always the person who said no.
Right. Exactly.
with my background as a developer, and one of the things I think has kept me away from data over the years has been I didn't want to be that guy.
You don't want to be that guy who says no all the time. Yeah, but it's almost like, like the job definition.
Exactly. And, with time and wisdom came, I understand why they had to say no. But I think that I think you're absolutely right, is that, we live in a world where business decisions are more and more, I think, reliant on data. So access to the data, it has to be more like a shop. And it's a shop, not kind of a free for all grab. So, you have to have some kind of governance and process in place. Is that a fair analogy?
It absolutely is. It's absolutely fair. Because there's two risks here. One, I think the most important risk is that if you don't give people access to data because you're being overly restrictive, they will get it somehow. When I was working at Microsoft, I was working visiting a customer site. And we found some data for the project we were working on. It was in a folder that was called /server name/ cappuccino. And this was a financial services company. We said, why is this folder called cappuccino? It's kind of a very strange name for a folder. Everything else is called things like reports and things like that. Well, why is this folder called cappuccino? It's full of CSV files. And the guy said, that's pretty straightforward. I'm not really meant to have this data. but every time I get an extract from the mainframe, I buy the administrator a cappuccino, and this just reminds me to buy her a cappuccino when I see a new file.
That's awesome.
Yep.
All their controls had kind of broken down at this point. Now, that's a danger. The funny thing about that problem is not only an amusing story, the guy was not a bad guy. He wasn't a bad actor, as they say. He wasn't trying to do damage. He wasn't trying to hack anything. He was just trying to do his job. But the controls around the system prevented him doing the job. And he'd found this workaround, and then the workaround had become part of the process. And I think there's a danger there that as a result, all of this was undocumented. There were files there which were now not properly controlled because they were now in open space, if you like, and that's a big problem. So that's one danger, is that people will work around this, not with bad intentions, with perfectly good intentions, but they'll work around it. The second danger is that you lock down the data, and people can't do their job, and they give up trying. And you end up with an IT department and a business department who hate each other, or at the very least are opposed to each other. And the business suffers as a result because people give up trying to do it. So, people will either work around it or they'll give up. And both of those are bad business outcomes.
No, that's true. And I think we can all anecdotally say there's that there's a lot of places where IT and business departments see each other as adversaries, not necessarily as allies on the same team.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, and it's a huge problem. So the shopkeeper analogy, in a sense, even though technically many of the things you do as a shopkeeper DBA would be similar to the things that you do as a traditional DBA, you create data feeds. You create them, which are data feeds which are integrated, and the quality is being controlled, and they're regularly maintained, and they're fit for purpose. So they're a data feed that's appropriate to give somebody. That's similar to what you might want to do as a traditional DBA. But the attitude is very different, and your relationship with the users is very different. So I think that's important.
Yeah, you're not the one who says no. You're the one who says it's going to cost you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, not necessarily in such a hostile way. That's the Jersey in me leaking out, Andy.
Yeah, it's going to cost you. But I think it's very important to do that. The other problem that people have is the DBA, the traditional role of the DBA, is also based on this concept that you can map out an architecture for your company that you fully understand and is fully governed and carefully managed. And the problem is that, as I was saying about the cappuccino problem, people will find a way around that. And there are other systems. We used to have what you'd call the flying floppy network back in the days. there might be a way in which the systems are properly integrated, but you throw a floppy disk across the room and somebody's got a copy of the data. And flying floppy networks are a very common way of sharing data. Nowadays, I have a different name for that. I call it Nakatomi space. Do you know where Nakatomi comes from?
Yes.
No.
No, it's a Nakatomi. You know where the phrase Nakatomi comes from, yeah?
I don't.
No,
well, I do. I do, but only because I'm a fan of those movies.
You're a fan of the movies, so I'll try to be polite about them. So Die Hard, when the first Die Hard.
Ah, yes.
The terrorists take over this new building called Nakatomi Plaza. And Nakatomi Plaza is this splendid construction. It's beautiful new office building. It has all the latest technology, all the latest security technology, all the latest. It has elevators. It has a huge kind of dramatic golden sweeping staircase. It has beautifully partitioned and laid out modern offices. And the terrorists take over this building, and Bruce Willis has got to kind of fight them off one by one. And the interesting thing about that is he navigates that space. He navigates Nakatomi Plaza with a completely parallel understanding of what that space means. So what I mean by that is he doesn't use the elevator. He uses the elevator shaft. He doesn't use if he wants to get into a building, he want to get into a room. He doesn't go through the door. He either smashes his way through the window or he crawls along the ventilation shaft. That certainly never goes along a corridor. He navigates the building in a way which is completely parallel to the architecture that the architects designed. The terrorists and the authorities are both at a disadvantage because they have looked at the architecture from the way it was designed. So, there are no alarms on the 23rd floor windows because who's going to smash in? Who's going to come through a 23rd floor window that doesn't open? Well, Bruce Willis is going to smash his way through that window. He sees the building as a set of opportunities for navigation that is completely different from the way the architect designed it. The architect and the terrorists think of the building in one way. He sees the building in another way. And so my challenge to data architects in this case, or system designers, is what's the Nakatomi space in your data architecture? How are people actually navigating it? How can they navigate? And I don't mean hackers. I just mean people who are trying to do their job. Well, the cappuccino folder was an example of Nakatomi space. People were doing things that are not allowed, if you like, or are parallel to the architecture. It's like a parallel world to the architecture that they thought of. Another example would be, if you've ever worked in a public business, have you worked for a public company?
I have, yeah.
Yeah. So when you're listed on the stock exchange, every quarterly result is important. Your stock price is greatly affected by quarterly results. So about 3 weeks before the end of the quarter, systems start to get locked down. You'll start to lock down the sales results because a lot of your sales typically will come at the very last you know, very end of a quarter, the sales guys are rushing around trying to close deals in order to get their results in. About 3 weeks, perhaps, before the end of a quarter, people start to lock down things like sales dashboards. And the reason for that is because that now becomes very sensitive information. The sales dashboard that managers have been using for the rest of the quarter to track performance suddenly becomes proprietary, and because of the risk of insider trading or effects on the stock price, material effects on the stock price, they start to lock down those systems.
Right.
That's pretty straightforward, and that's a technological approach to that problem. There is nothing stopping somebody standing around a water cooler talking about this quarter's performance.
Right.
True.
They are. If you're standing around a water cooler talking about data and talking about numbers, then you're collaborating on data. It's not locked down by any system. It might be totally impossible for that person to, share the data behind that dashboard. They might not be able to export it to Excel anymore and give you a floppy. They can still talk to you. So for all our work that we've done as data architects to try and lock down the system, we can't prevent people just talking about it. That's the Nakatomi space of the data world. And that's one of the spaces. So that's a real challenge, and how do you live in that world? And that's one of the reasons I suggest that trying to pretend we can lock everything down as gatekeepers is actually, it leads us astray.
That makes a lot of sense. And while we're quoting older movies, I think the line from Jurassic Park comes to mind. Life finds a way.
Right, exactly. Data finds a way.
Data finds a way.
I like that. Yeah, it's a good adaptation of that. And I love your thinking on that, Donald. It's more about, how business processes work in the real world, as opposed to, our thoughts at the outset of the project or, even when we're designing and even before that, when we're beginning to architect a design that will, serve our enterprise. We definitely approach it with blinders on. I can speak from experience, and having, done consulting for a number of companies, I know that when I walk in the door sometimes and look at their data model, some things usually leap out at me, and I can't explain how that happens, but I'll start asking questions about how this is related to that. And the first response is often, no, you're doing it wrong. You're looking at this wrong.
Right.
And then we'll go grab lunch maybe a week or so into the project, and that person will say, the way you looked at that, I hadn't thought of that before, but you're right. There is this relationship between all of these things, and it's just not, it wasn't obvious when we designed it. It's not obvious to the way we intended the data to be used. But that's how you see these mismatches in correlations inside of the data, the relationships that are either circular or incomplete. They can go both ways. But it's very interesting to think about that. How is this data consumed? How is this data put to work?
There are unintended consequences in every data model. When people design a data model, they generally have a particular set of scenarios in mind. And very often what happens is the business moves on, as businesses do. Businesses are continually evolving, but the data model hasn't. And so people start to, in various ways, they start to kind of overload the data model. They start to use it in ways in which it wasn't intended. Again, because it can be too slow to change the model, or because that new use case has never been captured. And that can lead to a lot of these kind of unintended consequences, which you, coming in as an experienced and insightful kind of consultant, will pick up. And they won't pick it up because they're still seeing it with the old mindset.
Well, I would say to thank you first for the compliment about being experienced and insightful. But my old, I live in Farmville, as you're well aware, and my old redneck ways, we refer to that as jacking it up. And usually when you jack something up around here, you're going to put it on cinder blocks, and it's going to set out front near the refrigerator on the porch or something like that. But it is. That I hadn't thought about the drift between the business needs and business purposes that were present when that architecture was put in place and the present. And that is a very interesting way to think about that, as it's You know, things have changed, but has the model changed? And the answer is no. Usually they don't.
I mean, how many times have you heard of, you know, or you've seen it where they put in all nines to indicate something?
Right.
You know, and I remember on, you know, September 9th, 1999, right. One of the big concerns was, you know, what's going to happen, you know? Because a lot of times they would put that in as the date.
Yeah, well, we always had that. We had that, you know, the year 2000 problem. I was in, where was I? It was in Palo Alto, actually. I was at a university bookshop in Palo Alto. And it was coming, it was December of 1999. And I don't even remember the time. There was big conflict going on in the Balkans. And it was over Kosovo. And the United States and the UK were bombing the Serbians at that time, or bombing Belgrade. And there was a guy there giving a lecture where he claimed that this was entirely due to the year 2000 problem, that all the cruise missiles had a year 2000 problem. So they had to use them up in November and December 1999. So they had to find a conflict where they could fling all these missiles in order to avoid. I think that was more of a conspiracy theory than a practical problem. But
probably.
I remember that I think New York State had said, because I was living in New York at the time, had said that they were going to double and triple check whoever was being released from prison on that day.
Right. Well, you'd hope they do that anyway, but yeah.
You hope you do that anyway, but, you know.
But here's the funny thing, you know, we all worried about the year 2000 problem, and people made a lot of money consulting on it. My sister dusted off her COBOL skills, and I think, you know, did pretty well out of it. But nothing happened. And then nothing really happened, and people then turned around and said, but that's because we fixed it all. So I don't know that that was true either, you know.
Yeah. Interesting spin there, to be sure. I was working as a manufacturing person at that time, doing manufacturing integration, and talked to a few people who were genuinely concerned, and I understood the fear. But I asked them, what do you think happens when these machines break today? The plant does not shut down, and trust me, they break. I know, because I get called to fix them sometimes, and they just, everything flips to manual, and you know, you continue working on that. And you know, there's a lot of lessons that we can pull, I think, out of those days and into our modern era, when we see people still being people even in the face of data. I think there's a couple of really good examples that would fit, especially in the political arena, around conspiracy theories. I think there's, you know, good and bad, accurate and inaccurate. I think there's a lot to be said about fear. And I know Frank likes the phrase fear and loathing, so I'll throw that in just for you. But, you know, and data, I think, helps this. But the misapplication of data, I've seen, you know, contribute to some, you know, some things that we don't really want to promote. So some really bad ideas get promoted by the misapplication of data. And, it goes back, I think, some to that old quote about statistics being, you know, or about lies, damned lies and statistics. We may be ready to put another phrase on the end of that, you know, and data science or big data or
yeah, well, you know, people often quote that Edward Deming phrase, that, you know, that quotation that without data, you're just another person with an opinion. You know? I think the problem is that with data, you're just another person with data and an opinion. just because you've got data doesn't mean you don't have opinions. We still bring all our biases when we bring data. You know, you talk about these, you know, the conspiracy theories and some of the things that goes on in politics. But, you know, if data solved the problem of politics, we wouldn't have a problem of politics. It's not as if people don't have data. We bring our data to these problems. That we have this tendency, though, to think that we're objective, but everybody else is biased. That's not true.
Well, I was just going to say that. I am objective, and, you know, everyone else is biased. Yeah. No, I know better.
I think there's a tremendous danger in people thinking that somehow just because they've looked at the data and they've brought the data, that they somehow have brought an understanding to it. There's a phrase I often use with people, and it goes back to 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume. And I really like this phrase. It is that an explanation is where the mind comes to rest. And
interesting.
What I like about that is when your mind comes to rest, it's where you're comfortable. I think that's the explanation, because I'm comfortable with it. Somebody else might not be comfortable and keep digging and keep digging into that data and find more things than you did. The very fact that you've found an explanation suggests that you're comfortable. I've done what I need to do now to explain this. Therefore, I can rest in my explanation.
That sounds very much like an engine for confirmation bias, or maybe an explanation for why confirmation bias is.
Well, that's because you're comfortable with that explanation.
Well, I was going to say that exactly. I was going there. I fell into that circular trap, and I'm still there.
Yeah, exactly. But isn't that interesting? And I think in the world of data, you know, you think of your data science and your statistics. You know, okay, I've looked at the statistics. I now have a statistical model that explains this, and I'm comfortable with it. But where do your statistics come from? Where does the underlying data come from? Are you comfortable with that? And what other explanations can there be? And you can just keep worrying away at this problem. It's fascinating, you know. And this is where we're in fascinating times. As our, not just our companies and our businesses, but as our entire lives become more driven by data, we have to become more literate about these things.
Absolutely. It's so true. I know Nassim Taleb has written some interesting work. He wrote Fooled by Randomness. He wrote The Black Swan. And I've been re-listening to Anti-Fragile, a book he wrote back in 2012. And he speaks about big data in the context of Fooled by Data, which I found fascinating because he's the only person I've heard say anything negative about big data.
Right.
But as big as life, he has a chart up there where he's charting spurious correlations on one axis, and on the other is the amount of records in the data set. And it's a curve. He says, you know, the more data we have, the more spurious correlations we're going to generate out of that. And I had not ever thought about that. But I was trying to, as I listened to him make that statement, I tried to go back through my clients, and I've done some big data work. And, you know, I think he's right.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I think he's a fascinating author. You know, The Black Swan is an interesting book. I have a friend, a Nigerian friend, very, very intelligent.
He's not a Nigerian prince, is he?
He's not a Nigerian prince. Doesn't work at a bank.
Just a second.
You know, I hate to say it, the National Bank of Nigeria used to be a Microsoft customer, and it was really difficult getting emails through the spam filter from them, you know? He's constantly having to go and check junk on these guys. Poor guys, I mean, they try sending an email from there. Anyway, my Nigerian friend, he read Nassim Taleb's book about the Black Swan, and he's a data scientist. He's a very smart guy. But he's only lived in the U.S. for about 8 years. He didn't have a clue what Nassim Taleb was talking about this big crisis that nobody had predicted, because he didn't live through it. To him, you know, he was a student at the time, and he wasn't particularly interested in the world of finance. And so the big crash that Nassim Taleb was talking about, my friend Michael would be looking around, reading this chapter, thinking, I have no idea what this guy's talking about. Nothing was wrong. Everything was fine, you know. The cars were running, the planes were flying, the shops were full of food. What was the problem? You know?
I guess the definition of crisis is somewhat relative.
Exactly, yeah. To him, this, but that's also one of these things. You know, that you're biased by your perception of the world. You know?
Very true.
So we have a couple of stock questions, Donald. We like to ask guests. So one is, complete this sentence. When I'm not working, I enjoy.
When I'm not working, I enjoy. Gosh, when I'm not working, I enjoy everything. I enjoy life. I enjoy life.
All right, we have to talk about the treehouse.
We do. I was going to say, you know, I would think you'd be in the treehouse and in the tree hive.
So yes, I do. So the tree hive, we call it the tree hive, and there's a wonderful television show called Treehouse Masters, where the exuberant treehouse builder, Pete Nelson, who happens to live quite near us, goes around the world, or at least around the country, around the US, building these wonderful treehouses. And my wife wrote to the show and said, you know, I'd like to build a treehouse. And she had an idea. She's an artist. And she had an idea for a treehouse that would look like a beehive, would look like a natural object just hanging in the tree rather than a cabin in a tree, which so many of them look like, but look like something natural. And they were enchanted by the idea, and we were on the program, and they came and they built this wonderful treehouse for us. And so I took the name of my business, Treehive Strategy, from that, because that's actually where I go to do a lot of my strategizing.
And we'll post a link to the video online. It's an awesome space.
Oh yeah, it is. Yeah, and, you know, actually, we have lots of those. We have a house which is the house that we live in is made of polystyrene, which is always kind of interesting. It's made of recycled polystyrene.
Really?
Yeah, that's always kind of cool. We have a little kind of house which I use for my morning meditation and things, which is made of doors. So it doesn't have any windows. It's all made of doors. So there's no walls. Just the house is made of 12 doors, and that's kind of fun. And they all open, they all lock, and they all close. We have a kind of octagonal hut with a fireplace in the middle that it's called the Goblin Hut. It actually appears in the Treehouse show as well, where we can sit and have parties in the winter. We have lots of these little sort of things that we've built that we use and things. But I love my treehouse, and I love my life. And you know, when I'm not working, well, work is part of life as well, of course. It's an important part. But as I've got older, just taking the time to appreciate what we actually do and what we have is such so important. You know?
That's an awesome sentiment, Donald. I completely agree with you. For folks who want to see a quick snapshot of the Treehive, it's at treehivestrategy.com. At the top there, your banner is a picture of the Treehive, and it's a fascinating structure.
Thank you. It is.
So one of the other questions is, I think the coolest thing in technology today is?
I think the coolest thing in technology today is renewable energy. And the reason I say that is because if you think of the world of technology and the way it's developed from the Industrial Revolution onwards, the source of energy has been incredibly important. From steam and steam power, suddenly this ability that we had to do things that were beyond human capacity. That was an amazing thing that came from steam. Of course, the invention of electricity, the discovery of electricity and the harnessing of electricity is similar. We've lived in an age of dependence on oil, which, you know, has driven so much of our history in the last century, from the dependence of oil, both in good ways and bad ways. Many of the wars and many of the actions that have been taken in wars, and you only need to look at the Second World War. They're not talking about Gulf War or anything like that. Even look at the Second World War, the need for the Germans to push into Eastern Europe in order to get to the Romanian oil fields. You realize how much which then, of course, in turn requires the Soviets to push back in that, and then you end up with the Eastern Bloc and the Western Bloc. You know, so much of our history has been driven by the need for energy, that this next phase of energy production will be the thing that changes it. And, you know, for good or for bad, actually for both, we know from history it'll be both. But it's going to be fascinating.
No, I totally agree. I think there are plenty of unintended consequences, because a lot of renewable energy technologies tend to be decentralized. The energy up until, you know, in the way back days, you know, everything was decentralized. But I think one of the things you've seen in the 20th century was things became centralized. And whereas I think with a lot of this renewable energy movement, you know, there's a lot of, effort to make going off grid easier.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, back in the, when you say things were decentralized, people had to generate their own electricity if you were right. a business and you wanted it. The title CEO originally, the first CEOs were actually chief electricity officers. The people who ran companies were called presidents at that time, and the chief electricity officer's job was to make sure that electricity generation was available, to make sure there were transformers working on every floor of the building and so on, you know. It's kind of funny.
Interesting.
So our last complete this sentence is, I look forward to the day when I can use technology to...
I look forward to the day when I can use technology to... Gosh, that's a really that's a really difficult one. What could I want to do with technology that I don't do today? You know, that's a really difficult one. I think probably for me, the areas in which I want to see technology advancing most are in areas like healthcare, but perhaps if I can use technology to solve social crises. I think that would be interesting. Okay. So there's an area I'm doing some work in, which I'm really interested in just now, which is using blockchain in some interesting ways. There's a project, for example, to tackle slavery using blockchain. And the way that would work is where today there's, if you think of workers in Middle East or in Africa, they're often hired from remote villages by gang masters who offer them all sorts of money and, all sorts of promises that when they get to this country and they're working in the construction sites, they'll get money to send home. And that money is gradually kind of filtered away by middlemen who take their cut until very, very little ever gets back to the home village. And these people are often bound into appalling kind of so-called contracts that they don't even know or understand, can't even read in many cases. And blockchain actually provides a way of ensuring that every link in the chain from the home village right through to the contractor, probably the multinational contractor building an airport in the Middle East on a construction site, that every link in that chain is public, is certified, and is trackable. And therefore, the contractor can look at it and say, you know, I've got across the building contractor can look and say, you know, I'm building this airport for billions of dollars, and there are 1,000 people working on here who are not getting any more than 50% of what they're due back to their home village. And that's actually possible to do with blockchain. And that would be a tremendous breakthrough. And so I'm really interested in the use of technology to solve that kind of social problem. And that's just one example. There's many, many examples of how technology could affect people in that way. And I think that's pretty exciting.
That is.
Interesting.
Yeah. Agreed with that. Donald, we have one other thing that's not a sentence to complete that we ask folks. If you've shared a bunch of things that are different about yourself already, but we do ask that question. Is there something else that is different about you that you'd care to share? We do have a reminder that it's a family podcast.
Yeah, we don't want that explicit rating.
There we go. Yeah. There's nothing different in that field. I think, yeah, there are some things that are different for me. I mean, so one thing, Andy, that I know you're aware of because we've talked about in the past is I'm a pacifist. Been a pacifist all my life. And never, or does it never question? That's not quite the right way to put it, but never wavered. And that's a very, very important thing to me. And I'm a pacifist, comes from a family of many of whom have served in the military with great distinction. But that's okay. I don't feel any, we get on very well and we have no distinction about that. But it does actually affect the way in which I look at life. Because it turns out that in my work, and in my business, I'm very focused on resolving conflict, and I'm very focused on understanding the roots of conflict, and I'm very focused on my role in that. And it's a very personal thing. I'm not a, if you like, a political pacifist. I would never go out and try and convert someone. I think it's a personal choice. But it does mean I'm really interested in resolving conflict and in understanding conflict. And that influences a great deal of what I do. And as I go through life and work, I find that most people actually aren't. A lot of people enjoy a little bit of conflict. It's kind of fascinating to me that it is so different to have this view of the world. But there you go.
Well, you may not know this, but our conversations about your beliefs on pacifism have actually challenged my beliefs on not being one. And I have moved more that direction than I was in the past. I don't know where I'll end up, but it was an influence on me. And I think just listening to you explain it, the fact that you weren't aggressive about your pacifism was very refreshing. And in your sharing, at least with me, you demonstrated what you were talking about. While you were preaching, you were practicing what you preached. And I think that went a long way to making me pause and reconsider some of my stances on stuff. So I thank you.
It is just difficult not to preach, isn't it? Thank you, Andy. You know, it's like there's that old joke about how do you spot a vegan at a party? The answer is, don't bother. You'll find out soon enough.
Oh, I love that. I'm going to use that if you don't mind. Wow, so this is... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Unattributed.
I'll be happy to footnote it to you. So this has been an excellent conversation. Where can people find out more about what you're doing at TreeHive?
So they can look at my website, treehivestrategy.com, and there'll be a blog coming out as well at treehivestrategy.net, but that's just a placeholder site just now. But I'll be working on that over the summer once my work kind of quietens down a little bit. But treehivestrategy.com is where to go just now.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for your time. And this is Frank signing off for Data Driven. Say goodbye to the good folks, Andy.
Goodbye, good folks. And thank you, Donald.
Thank you very much. Great pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Data Driven. Don't just listen. Become a data driver by going to datadriven.tv to sign up to join the community, access to special events, tips and tricks, and more. Sign up today at datadriven.tv.